Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Monday, the 13th of January, and again, just so happy that you could be with us. My guest today is Anna Kesey, and I'm so pleased to invite her to the show. She's written a terrific book called Little Century. And before we get into that, let me just say that I am Stephen Long, author of There's a Somebody. And I'd love to hear from you. We're having a little contest, and we need to name the show. So if you would contact me either through my website, stephenwlong.com, or the Facebook page, There's a Somebody, you can give me your suggestion. But for now, let me welcome Anna to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Well, Anna, we know each other a little bit. We were both at the last year's Tarawa Creative Writing Festival, and I was busy, and I didn't get to hear you, and I think that you probably didn't get to hear me, so maybe we can rectify that this year.
Sure.
But the main thing, I want to talk about your book, which
okay.
I read eagerly. I wrote to you about this, so this some of this won't be new to you, but I just fell in love with it, with the characters, and particularly the writing, which is one of the big appeals for me when I read something is the voice. And
mm-hmm.
can you talk a little bit about how you developed this voice? It just seems so authentic given the period that you were writing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. I mean, some of it simply comes from having read a lot of 19th century novels myself. So
mm-hmm.
there's some part of my brain that can isolate some of the speech patterns and some of the language that's characteristic of that time. That we should say that the book is set in the year 1900 in
mm-hmm.
Central Oregon, and so it's the beginning of the 20th century, but it's essentially these are, you know, 19th century people.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's also there's also the question of actual 19th century speech and writing. One can't imitate it directly because it would sound really mannered or
mm-hmm.
kind of, you know, long-winded, tedious to contemporary ears. So I'm really trying to do a version of that kind of speech and narration that has
mm-hmm.
that is contemporary but has these kind of 19th century or kind of antique features to it, so that it has the flavor of the past without being without the limitations of past ways
sure.
of narrating stories. Yeah, and I also think you know, there's a certain kind of relatively stripped down quality, except in certain places, that is just native to my voice. I mean, I think it's relatively spare and kind of romantic. So I don't know how you get both those things in, but I think both
mm-hmm.
of those are part of my sensibility. It's also actually, I think, in fact, it's probably affected a lot by the landscape in which it's set. You know, that is, it's set in the Central Oregon
sure.
desert, and the austerity of that landscape, I think, suggests a kind of meditative, stripped down way of being, you know, in that landscape and being and thinking, because it's the largeness of it and the beauty
mm-hmm.
of it, which is a kind of desolate or kind of beauty. I think that landscape sort of defeats ornate prose, defeats ornate thinking. You know,
sure.
you don't
sure.
have a lot of time to add a lot of adjectives onto things because it's either because it's action is what's required. I'm not sure how to express that. It's something about the relationship between language and action. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I had a slightly different take. I wouldn't have called the language spare. It's certainly not flowery, or ornate, as you said. And I think, having just read Joe Wilkins' book, which is set in a kind of a similar terrain, and I think I picked that up there too. And I was thinking that the people, it's almost, an iconic American approach that they're just people of few words. And I think you're right. I hadn't put it in those terms, but the work is so serious and life is so serious. There's not a lot of time for fluff and messing around, and you just have to get down to it. So I appreciate your take. I hadn't thought of it in those terms before.
Well,
but now let me say this also.
Oh, sure.
In one of my many writing classes, the teacher said dialogue in a novel is not actual speech, but it gives the illusion of actual speech. And I think that that's kind of what you're talking about, maybe in a slightly different way. It gives the illusion of speech in that era, although you've modified it so that we can read it and stay interested and engage with the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's always any fictional representation of the world is modified and filtered. You know, it's distilled, a distilled version, but it's distilled in a particular direction. You know, I recently read a quotation that said that something like life is the field of corn, art is the whiskey, or fiction is the whiskey. You know, so it's literally distilled.
Okay,
you know, and the world is the raw material. But as we know, sort of whiskeys and all, you know, any spirit made from grain can be oriented in a bunch of different ways. So whatever we see is or flavored in a bunch of different ways. So everything we see is a distillation, a filtered version, literally an artificial representation. It's an artifact, a thing that represents the real world. So yeah, it gives the illusion while not being the thing. That's really an interesting quality of fiction. It's a representation, but it persuades us that it's a real thing, a real experience.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the suspension of disbelief.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you need that. And it's interesting. I think that approach is applicable to so many things. I have a friend who's quite a renowned painter, and one of the things he paints is landscape. And he has said, really, a painting is not a photograph. And so his filter is that he selects the items that he's going to show. I think an author does that. In fact, again, I draw from one of my classes, the telling detail. So you don't say every little thing. You don't write down everything in the scene, or every action, but you pick those things that convey the emotion or the sensibility that you want to convey. So, which makes each author their own filter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
The story's is filtered through that author.
That's right. And you could even sort of take it further and say that each time an individual writer approaches a new project, whether short or, you know, novel length, he or she is aggregating or sort of constituting a new filter that's appropriate to that material, that takes a new perspective. And so, the, you know, different details will leap up as being significant. And,
right.
I mean, there's something that I talk about in creative writing classes where when students sometimes are first learning kind of the principle of providing details in order to understand, in order to render character to their readers, they may do what I call the all points bulletin characterization, where they'll say that the character is 5'7" and has blue eyes and shoulder length brown hair, and and so we talk about the fact that those are specific tales that are in fact insignificant in rendering character, so that there's what one is always looking for is a specific detail that is significant, that has a cargo of meaning that goes with it.
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. I'm sort of thinking about that. I have a character in Little Century. Her name's Violet Fowler. She's the postmistress, and she's a bit of a busybody, and is sort of self-important in a certain way. And I mean, I could say that she's 5'4" and that she's got blonde hair that's turning gray, and she's got olive-colored eyes, and she's kind of long-waisted and has big hands or something like that. Like that, I could say all those things, which are sort of a general way that I picture her. But I don't give any details like that about her. The detail I do give is that she's got she wears a little tiny hat and a women's Christian temperance ribbon on her dress that is always fluttering in the breeze, and she looks, and her face makes her look a little bit like a wooden puppet. And those details have to do with the values she espouses, the fact that there's something artificial and easily manipulated about her, and that she's sort of fussy and alert. You know, that's maybe my own sort of personal association with this little tiny hat that she wears. But those details that ultimately in combination and in the context of the way she behaves, you know, what she says and whom she speaks to and how and so on, through the novel, they are details that carry a freight of meaning about her character, that simply saying that she had green eyes would not do, wouldn't touch.
Hang on.
That's a long example.
I'm so sorry. This is Julia. I'm just going to cut in. Steven's call dropped, but he's back. Hang on one sec. Let me just get him back
on.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hi, I'm back, yeah.
Okay, we're good. Yeah, just keep going.
Okay.
Okay. We're all good. Okay, thanks.
Anna, I'm sorry I missed that. I'm sure it was a terrific example.
But, yes, it was a very long example, Steve, I'll tell you that.
And it was timed perfectly.
Okay.
We had a little technical difficulty. But,
okay.
We're talking about some details, and particularly about fiction being a representation. It seems that, and maybe honestly you can explain this, I'm not trying to be cute here.
Sure.
The term creative nonfiction. What?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That seems like such an oxymoron. Where can you talk about that?
Yeah. Let's see. I think people think about it differently. The genres as we know them, the major genres as we know them, used to be, I think, more dramatically delineated. And what we would think of as nonfiction used to be basically journalism, right? Reportage.
Mm-hmm.
And but then at a certain point in, I would say in the 50s and 60s, right? There developed a form of journalism which they then called the New Journalism, which was more immersive and which used some of the techniques of narrative fiction. So, the
mm-hmm.
reporting of dialogue, the use of details of setting, the use of scene and summary to move, to storytell about the news.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a kind of a bridging form between fiction and what we would have then, previously called like the essay or the familiar essay, the kind of essay that was, popularized by Montaigne, back
mm-hmm.
in the day.
Okay.
And so now there's this tremendous range of ways to write artistically about actual experience. So that's what I would say. It's writing about actual experience and factual information, in the world, but writing about it for the purpose of art making rather than reporting.
Right. Okay.
For instance, there's this beautiful essay that I always use in my memoir class called The Fourth State of Matter by Joanne Beard. It's a tremendous, tremendous writer. And it's the account of her, the account of a number of things, she's a student at the University of Iowa who also works for the physics department and helps produce their journal, and she's very close to all the professors who work there. And then lo and behold, there is a terrible, tragic shooting, which some people will remember. This was in, I think, 1991, and a number of these people were killed not long after she had actually left the office. But she writes this beautiful essay, and it's not meant to report the way a journalist would on the events of that day, although it does tell us a lot about the events of that day,
mm-hmm.
but it's about her experience of it and the fact that it happens in the context of her, of other things in her life. Her marriage was falling apart. Her soon-to-be ex-husband was acting completely crazy. She had a beloved dog who was dying. She was trying to understand some of the research that her friends in the physics department were doing about the
mm-hmm.
about celestial physics, basically. And so
okay.
all these things are threads that move through this essay, and so her point is not to report on this incident, but to make a personal and artistic, to make an artwork based on her very, very individual experience of those things happening. And so that's what
mm-hmm.
I would call creative nonfiction, is that the purpose is art rather than reporting. And
okay.
sometimes those can be very close together. So we have to think of it as a continuum rather than and at one end is pure art making, and at one end is pure journalism.
Right.
And a lot of what we would call creative nonfiction occupies a space someplace in the middle of that continuum.
I'm thinking of Pat Conroy's The Death of Santini as an example. And so there'll be snatches mm-hmm. of dialogue, and at the same time that I'm intrigued, I have to believe that probably that's not word for word.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the gist of what happened, and maybe mostly the words that were used. But who can recall, in the heat of the moment, every single word, to make that an accurate quote? And like you said, that's not the purpose. And I think the reader at least most readers probably know that.
Mm-hmm.
And just accept,
right.
Just accept it.
Yeah, I mean, well, I can give an example of, I mean, that is the reader who purports to, or the, excuse me, the writer who is purporting to talk about actual events and about real life has a pretty a significant responsibility to the reader to cleave as closely to the truth as possible, or as close and as close as possible to the truth as the writer understands it. Now, there's always mm-hmm. The fact that we can't always know and the fact that we can't always remember is often part of the material of memoir. You know, so mm-hmm. that is. A writer may tell a story and may say, also, you know, in a memoir, in an essay that's memoir, may say, but my sister disputes this. She says, da da da, you know.
Right.
But and yet, what I remember is this. I mean, ultimately, I mean, to me, I think the writer's responsibility is to be as honest as he or she can, but according to her own lights. You know, that is, this
sure.
is how it seemed to me. And plenty of creative nonfiction writers, memoirists in particular, do quite a bit of research about their own memories. They, you know, talk to other people and confirm whether
siblings.
Certain things are true. Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, and then there, I think it's generally understood that people can make changes that do not significantly affect the truth, do not significantly affect the meaning. You can make changes
right.
to that are insignificant, but make the piece work better. You know, for instance, I wrote an essay about a while back about what was partly about my very, very bad dog, who was a very troublesome from square one, but also about deciding to become a single mother, trying to become pregnant, and some other stuff having to do with that, and you know, and for instance, in that essay, there were several things that different people said to me at the time, but I gathered, and they were just different friends, boyfriends, so on, and I kind of gathered them and gave them to a single character. It just made it easier.
Sure.
Because what was important was what I heard and what people said to me, not that it was said to me by a number of different people, right? And
sure.
It felt to me authentically that it did not affect the meaning of what I was saying, and it didn't affect the truth of what I was saying to combine those people into one character. So that's kind of how I think about it, creative nonfiction.
Okay. No, that mm-hmm. in fact, some of that that you just mentioned, I'm flashing back to Conroy's book and see that in there. So I have to tell you, I feel like I've got a little bit of a captive, not an audience, but a captive teacher in you. And so I'm going to ask you some writerly things.
Okay.
And one of these things actually was asked of me. I was in Hollywood, and we gave a little talk, two other authors and me. After the talk, a mm-hmm. Member of the audience raised his hand and said, I'm writing, in fact, I think his was a memoir, and he said, how do you know when you're done? And so mm-hmm. I gave him my answer, but how would you respond to that? How do you know when you're done? And I think probably what he's talking about is rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your,
yeah.
when did you know?
well, you know, I have a number of thoughts about that, but the first thing that leaped into my mind was, I know it's done when I can read it from the beginning to the end without having that sinking feeling. when I can read it from the beginning to the end and it maintains energy, I don't lose focus.
Right.
And I mean actually literally reading it aloud. But I realize I did not read my entire novel aloud. Although, you know, in aggregate, I probably did, because
sure.
I read everything aloud at least once. And, you know, and a part of it is there's a very practical thing, which is that at a certain point, it's just your work. You just have to put it out there and move on, because you've got something else that you need to write. But a lot of people say that work isn't finished, it's just abandoned. And I look at this novel now, which I worked really hard on, and I revised many, many times over, you know, a longish period of time. And I still, and because I'm changing, and I'm a little older, and I can see things that I wish were a little different. I made changes in the book between the hardback and the paperback that I think were significant. I mean, they didn't change the story much, but they were significant to me. You know, there was like, this
sure.
sentence just doesn't really work, or it doesn't really do what I want it to do. So I was able to make some little tweaks to it. I mean, part of it is, you know, maybe you know when you're done when you have more than one reader who can read it with pleasure and understanding from beginning to end, and then you yourself can read it with pleasure and understanding and without
mm-hmm.
that sinking feeling from beginning to end.
And one of those readers is not your mother, is that?
That's right. That's right.
We'll have to put that
your
in
mother
there.
Is a bonus. You know, you get your mother's your bonus reader, but it's got, you've got to please a couple of other people. And, you know, and I was just looking, I'm teaching an introduction to creative writing class right now, actually, and the, I was looking at some videos. I was looking for a particular video of Kurt Vonnegut on YouTube in which he talks about the structure of a story, and he, and, but there, I ran across a little video that's a list of advice that he gave to writers, and one of the first thing he says was, you have to use the time of a complete stranger in such a way that it will not be wasted, will not have been wasted.
Oh, that sounds like Vonnegut.
Yes, and you know, it's, but it is very, I mean, on a basic level, that's it, you know.
Sure.
You need to not waste people's time. It cannot be boring. It cannot be trivial. It can be playful and hilarious and goofy, but it can't be boring and it can't be trivial. So that's how I know.
Okay. You've jogged a memory for me. I remember reading about a little thing that Kurt Vonnegut wrote about writing seminars and people going away for a weekend
right.
to learn to write. And, you know, he's pretty curmudgeonly. And
uh-huh.
he said, would we entertain the idea of a weekend seminar for surgeons? So if you're a letter carrier, but you've always wanted to be a surgeon, could you go away for a Saturday and Sunday and come back as a surgeon? Why would you think that you could learn to write over the weekend? I hope lots and lots of people listen to this, but I hope a particular friend of mine doesn't, because I'm going to talk about him. I had been taking classes for quite some time in writing, and I'd you know, had some success in various contests and so on, and I had an occasion to talk to my friend who was successful in his own right, and he said, well, you know, writing is easy. Just take an interesting subject and write about it in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, gee, I have been just wasting my time going to all these seminars and taking classes, and I should have just listened to you. That would have been easy.
Yes,
but,
yes.
When I said it like that, I think he kind of realized he was being a little silly too.
Right. So, well, it's a facetious answer, but it's got some truth in it for sure.
I guess. I want to ask you something, too. Your novel is written, if I recall correctly, in present tense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, could you, I've told people writing again is like painting or probably playing a musical instrument or any creative endeavor, and that is there are just lots and lots of choices to be made. And so that's a choice that you made, and I wondered how you came upon that.
Well, and again, the first thing that leaps to my mind is because that's what worked. I have to say to myself, why did that work, rather than writing in past tense? And I think that I wrote a very initial draft of this story, which is very, very different, but initial draft of the story in the first person and the past tense. And now it's in the third person and the present tense. And so you can see how much it had to develop and my understanding of it changed. pardon me. I think that there are probably two reasons why the present tense worked for me as I was writing. Partly, we always put something in a form that will allow us to keep writing so that we don't just get mired up and stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that this is what worked. And I think the reasons are that one is that it's a coming of age novel, a Bildungsroman, and the situation is a young woman who comes to an unfamiliar place and carrying her own burdens and has to begin to understand what is initially this kind of opaque culture of this small cattle town in Central Oregon, and so her understanding is unfolding as we watch rather than in retrospect.
So it is present tense.
Yeah, so it seems to me that it's actually...
It's present tense for her, too.
Yes, yes. She's not in a place where her memories make a great deal of difference. Her immediate experience and what she is able to construct of her immediate experience is... You know, she has to live essentially in the present, and so it seems to speak to what her experience actually is, and the feeling of so that we have to occupy the same space she does, which is that this place is a mystery, and will one ever know enough about it to feel comfortable and to feel grounded and to feel that it's meaningful and not just this kind of stage set with, you know, dust blowing across it. But the other thing is that I think in writing historical fiction, it's easy to fall into the trap of putting historic distance or temporal distance between oneself and the characters, you know, particularly in the past tense, if you're using the past tense, such that they seem quaint or diminished.
We already know they're removed, and now you're just accentuating that.
Yes, yeah. And so it seems to me that watching them in the present tense, or unfolding their story in the present tense means that the reader... We have to stay right up close to them and watch them act and watch them make their decisions in the moment rather than with a kind of hindsight or I wouldn't say the arrogance necessarily, but the complacency of occupying a later historical moment than they do. I think it demands more. It actually demands a little more respect of the characters to have it in the present tense. And it is simply more intimate, more immediate with their actual experience, both for me writing it and hopefully for people reading it.
Well, you talked about ultimately you make decisions that make your piece work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking I did it a little bit different than you did. My first novel was... initially written third person past tense, and I always felt that it just lacked something. Mm-hmm. And the final version, the published version, is first-person present tense, so a little bit different than your setup. But and that's what I was looking for. I was looking for two things. One was the immediacy of mm-hmm. present tense, and I just felt that my protagonist got lost in... He does some reprehensible things and makes mm-hmm. just a scad of poor decisions. And in third person, the reader is looking at that and saying, you know, what a dummy. Why is he doing that? And mm-hmm. my hope was that in first person, at least you're seeing the world and these decisions through his eyes. And I hope that helped to some extent.
Mm-hmm,
but
that
was a great
sense
answer.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me.
Well, Anna, before I let you go, where can we get the book? And in fact, where can somebody contact you?
Sure. Well, you can get the book, I think, in many independent bookstores. That I won't be the first outlet I always recommend. Our hometown bookstore is Third Street Books in McMinnville, Oregon, but there are many independent bookstores that I would urge people to go to look for the book. It's in paperback now, and out from Picador Press, and it can also be ordered online from Powells.com, from Amazon, various places. Again, I'd urge people to always think first of an independent bookseller. People can get in touch with me through my website. It's www.annakeesey.com, annakeesey.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Gmail address there that people can just click on and send me an email. And I love to hear from folks and often do.
Absolutely.
It's just delightful. So,
it's great. And not to be confused with another Keezy. I different spelling.
No, not yes, different spelling. Although for most of my adult life, I've had people give me a sharp eyed glance to see if I was a K-E-S-E-Y Keezy masquerading
right.
as a K-E-E-S-E-Y Keezy, because I'm about the right age to be a child of of Ken Keezy, a great Oregon fiction writer. And I went to Stanford as an undergrad, and he spent time at Stanford, and
sure.
so on. But we're not related, except in spirit, perhaps.
Well, I was going to say, not to take one thing away from Ken Keezy, but you're doing just fine on your own. You're a wonderful writer, and I so enjoyed your book, and can't wait for the next one. And in fact, that leads me to: are you writing another one? Do you have something planned?
Yes, actually, I am writing another one. Although I hesitate to talk about it much because partly because I know how these things completely
mm-hmm.
morph, and the thing that you think is the point or the important character early on may end up on the cutting room floor, and you go a completely different direction, and then people say, "Well, but what about that?"
Right.
What about that astrophysicist you were talking about? I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about him. But I am working on another book that doesn't look like it'll be historical. It looks like it'll be contemporary, set in the contemporary Northwest mostly, but we'll deal with some of the same issues that I'm interested in, sort of the landscape and water politics and
sure.
The social world, who knows? We'll see.
Which all figured into the first book as well.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. And we talked a little bit about Terroir, the Creative Writing Festival. I'm going to be involved to some extent. I hope to see you there this year.
And I hope
we'll find
too.
Out about that. All right. Well, all right. Be good. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. Thanks
all right.
for having me. Bye.
Take care. Thanks. Well, this is Stephen Long.
Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.